Afterward. One of the most remarkable facets of post-World War II American life was the sheer number of people with something they wanted to hide. The Pearl Harbor attack of December 7, 1941, changed the country's political scene overnight, ending the debate over isolationism versus intervention for good. America was now at war, and even those who had opposed its entry rallied around the flag. Hitler's American friends slunk into the darkness, or had to face the music for their past actions. As will be seen, some had no choice in the matter. Others managed to successfully disappear from post-war history and, presumably, lived out their lives in some form of blissful obscurity. After 1945, many Americans tried to simply forget the recent past's more troubling aspects. With post-war economic prosperity, the baby boom, and the American dream arriving for many white middle-class Americans, the late 1940s and early 1950s were seen as a time to focus on family and the future. Occasionally, the veil of the past was lifted, and the scarred face of the 1930s would briefly be revealed for public scrutiny once more. This could carry major consequences. The most prominent example was during the Red Scare of the early 1950s, when suddenly the clubs and associations one had belonged to, and the company one had kept, were under intense public scrutiny and could destroy present-day livelihood. Following the example of Representative Martin Dias Jr., Senator Joseph McCarthy was obsessed with tracking down communists wherever they could be found, instilling fear among those who had once cavorted with the left. But what if McCarthy's interest had been hunting former Nazi sympathizers rather than communist fellow travelers and party members? What if the former members of America First and the German-American Bund had faced the same consequences and social approbation that former communists and socialists encountered? These are unanswerable questions, but they highlight the fact that millions of Americans supported causes and groups before the war that would have, at a minimum, not reflected well on them later. For much of the 20th century, and even the early 21st, average Americans were unwittingly next-door neighbors with former German-American Bund members, America Firsters, and Silver Legion fanatics, American students who studied and traveled in the Third Reich, returned home to raise families and pursue successful careers. How many of them ever discussed their experiences in any depth will never be known, but it likely depended on how far their Nazi sympathies had led them. The U.S. National Archives contains an unknown, but assuredly huge number of FBI files opened on Hitler's American friends before and during the war. Many of them remain classified and can only become available after a lengthy Freedom of Information Act review. We may realistically never know how many Americans were suspected of being Nazi sympathizers or made contributions to the pro-German cause. What is known, however, is that only the most prominent of Hitler's friends faced legal sanctions for their activities. The rest, presumably, tried to simply keep their heads down and move on with life. The German-American Bund always maintained that it was a patriotic, cultural heritage organization, but the truth about its ideological orientation was not hard to uncover. It had always been essentially a one-man show built around the dynamic Fritz Kuhn and his flair for the dramatic. With Kuhn sitting in prison and the government keeping a close eye on its activities, the Bund quickly withered. His successors did little to save the organization he had built. Notorious West Coast leader Hermann Schwinn was forcibly denaturalized in November 1940, and Kuhn's national successor, Gerhard Kunze, resigned as Bund leader in 1941. As seen, he then fled to Mexico with the help of contacts in the Abwehr. He was eventually sent back to the United States, where he was convicted of a range of offenses and ended up spending more than a decade behind bars. His successor as Bund leader, George Frabuza, committed suicide on the railroad tracks in 1942, rather than face a grand jury subpoena. Kuhn himself remained in prison, and in 1943, had his naturalization revoked on the grounds that he had maintained allegiance to a foreign power in violation of his oath to the United States. After the war, he was deported to Germany and returned to Munich, initially as a free man. A year later, he was arrested for questioning as a potential war criminal and held in the Dachau concentration camp. Dramatically, he managed to escape from the camp and went on the run. He was eventually recaptured and imprisoned until 1950. He died in late 1951. Even this fate was less grim than that of his predecessor in Friends of the New Germany. Heinz Spanknobel had fled to Germany in the early 1930s to avoid potential prosecution in the United States and return to a life of obscurity. During the war, he ended up in the German army, was captured by the Soviets, and died of starvation in 1947. There were no happy endings for Hitler's most prominent American friends. The man who had done so much to crack open the Boone's inner workings for both the government and the American public, John C. Metcalf, returned to his career in journalism. During the war, he worked as a diplomatic correspondent for Time and other publications. In 1948, he founded a lecture bureau and represented prominent political clients, including Truman Administration Vice President Alvin W. Barkley. In the late 1960s, he returned to government service as part of the State Department's Agency for International Development. He died in 1971. While the Boones never achieved the widespread popularity for which its leaders hoped and critics feared, German Americans nationwide did demonstrably become increasingly disenfranchised from the Roosevelt administration. In the election of 1940, which Roosevelt won handily, there were only 20 counties where he lost by more than 35% of the vote. 19 of those 20 were majority German-speaking, indicating a large percentage of recent immigrants or those who closely guarded their cultural heritage. Dozens of other heavily anti-Roosevelt counties also reported high numbers of German-origin residents. 4 years later, entire Midwestern states with high German populations, including Kansas and Iowa, flipped to vote Republican. While the vast majority of German Americans did not join the Bund and were demonstrably loyal to the United States, they were also not fans of their adopted country entering a second war against the fatherland. As it turned out, Metcalf was not the only journalist who had gone undercover among Hitler's American friends. In 1943, Armenian-American author Arthur Derunian published a sensational book entitled Undercover, under the pen name John Roy Carlson. In 1939, Derunian infiltrated the New York City Bund and went on from there to join groups associated with Father Coughlin and other lesser-known extremist organizations. His first-person account of conversations with far-right plotters, hoping to eventually overthrow the U.S. government, was shocking to many and immediately made his book a bestseller. Carlson showed no reluctance in naming the leaders of Hitler's American friends, subjecting them to public attention and ridicule. Notably, he reserved special ire for the isolationist senators and representatives who became involved in America First. Among the most upset was Senator Burton K. Wheeler, who inserted attacks on the book and its author into the congressional record and called for an investigation. His outrage would have little effect. The book was heavily touted by anti-Nazi columnist and radio commentator Walter Winchell, who encouraged his listeners to pick up a copy. As will be seen, Undercover was not the last exposé published about Hitler's American friends, but it did much to make the public aware of the danger posed by groups many had never heard of previously. Wheeler's fears about the book's potential political impact would also prove well-founded. Through publications like Undercover, the extent of Hitler's American network was gradually revealed to the public after Pearl Harbor. Yet by that time, the most effective German plot had already been shut down with significant help from the British. George Sylvester Viereck's successful propaganda and intelligence operation on Capitol Hill was the most direct assault on the U.S. government by German agents. And while he had never been able to use his network to the maximum extent that might have been possible, it was still a serious threat to national security. Viereck himself had been arrested in October 1941, putting his operation out of business. He was convicted in March 1942 of failing to reveal the full extent of his activities as a foreign agent. The witnesses presenting evidence against him included one of the British censorship examiners who had helped intercept his letters to Germany. George Hill, the aide who had given him access to the Congressional Franking Service, had already been convicted of perjury and testified against Viereck as well. This was not the end of Viereck's legal battles, however. He appealed his sentence, and the case eventually ended up in the U.S. Supreme Court. Viereck's attorneys argued that because the Foreign Agents Registration Act had been passed when he was already working as a German agent, it could not be applied to activities undertaken before the law was passed. The Supreme Court agreed, and Viereck's conviction was overturned in March 1943. This itself proved to be only the prelude to a bigger legal fight. In December 1942, a federal grand jury indicted Viereck and more than two dozen other Americans with sedition and violations of the Espionage Act of 1917. The resulting sedition trial, as it became known, ensnared nearly all the big names of 1930s anti-Semitism. Gerald B. Winrod was among the first to be indicted, along with fascist intellectual Lawrence Dennis, Silver Legion chief William Dudley Pelley, Paul Revere's founder and Red Baiter Elizabeth Dilling, Bund leaders Gerhard Wilhelm Kunze, and Hermann Max Schinn, and a host of lesser names. Notably, Father Charles E. Coughlin was not indicted. The federal prosecutor in charge of the case was O. John Roga, the Justice Department rising star who had been brought in to investigate Coughlin's Christian Front in Brooklyn. The legal basis of the trial was questionable from the start. Roga recounted later that his primary concern was the case's potential First Amendment implications. Did not this amendment protect all manner of advocacy, even that which was part of a conspiracy to cause a violation of the law? He reflected. It was a good question. Making anti-Semitic statements was not against the law, and the Espionage Act required proof of an actual plot to be applicable. A more applicable piece of legislation, called the Smith Act, had been passed in 1940 to combat subversion by communists and had a lower evidentiary standard. This was the path Roga chose, arguing that the defendants intended to harm the morale of the U.S. military because they had unlawfully, willfully, feloniously, and knowingly conspired with officials of the government of the German Reich and leaders and members of the said Nazi Party. To prove this case, however, Roga would have to show that the defendants were all part of the same conspiracy, even if they did not know one another directly or coordinate their actions. There was, of course, no evidence to support either of these claims. As critics of the trial wrote afterward, Roga was left to argue that the defendants were like the Nazis because both were anti-Semitic. Hence, the defendants were part of a Nazi world movement to cause insubordination in the armed forces. This was outlandish at best. No one was arguing that the defendants were upstanding citizens. But there was no evidence to support the idea that they were all part of an actual conspiracy to undermine military morale. There was also a distinct political risk in all this. Viereck's operation had included some of Washington's most powerful politicians, and the evidence against him would inevitably lead to their names being revealed in court. This was considered to be such a sensitive matter that British security coordination declined to make its evidence available to the court and refused to let its personnel testify at the trial because it would be likely to implicate a number of distinguished congressmen and national figures. The sedition trial finally began in April 1944. The judge was former Congressman Edward C. Eicher, a Roosevelt ally and a liberal. Roga was left to prove an almost impossible case. There was no question that the defendants had made anti-Semitic and pro-Nazi statements. Many of them were even willing to repeat those statements in court. The problem was that it was not illegal to hold and express those views, especially before the United States entered the war. To overcome this, the prosecution presented the theory that the accused seditionists had all echoed the same themes as Nazi propaganda. Using the work of propaganda expert Harold Laswell, 14 common Nazi propaganda themes were identified. The central ones were anti-Semitism and anti-communism. The prosecution then compared the writings and statements of the defendants to Laswell's 14 themes, to argue that they were all part of a pro-Nazi conspiracy, even if they weren't aware of it. This was outlandish, and held very little legal weight. The trial itself became a circus, as the defendants openly mocked the court. Some wore signs to the court reading, "I am a spy," to annoy prosecutors and the judge. The entire process was quickly descending into farce. Yet the Roosevelt administration was convinced the alleged seditionists must be punished, and so it continued. More than 18,000 pages of testimony were generated, and dozens of witnesses were called. On November 29, 1944, a former employee of Gerald B. Winrod took the stand to testify against the Kansas Evangelist. As he spoke, Winrod claimed to have a prophetic vision. While the young man was testifying, a glance once in the direction of the judge. Suddenly, a heavy black shadow, like a thick cloud, a dark veil, covered his face. It seemed to drop down and envelop him. The hand of death was evidently upon him at that moment. Winrod's prophecy was correct. Later that night, Judge Eicher died of a heart attack in his sleep. The government's case was now in serious trouble. The defendants themselves had to be asked whether they were willing to continue under a new presiding judge. Nearly all refused to go on. A week after Eicher's death, there was no choice but to declare a mistrial. It was an ignominious end to a quixotic legal effort. As the Chicago Daily Tribune put it bluntly, "Thus ended the pending effort of the Department of Justice to prove that the defendants, including a collection of obscure anti-war, anti-Semitic, and anti-communist propagandists, all opponents of the Roosevelt administration, had conspired to undermine the loyalty and morale of the Army and Navy and set up a Nazi form of government in the United States." Various attempts to revive the case went nowhere, but it would take until 1947 for the government to formally abandon the case for good. The accused seditionists felt vindicated. Fascist intellectual Lawrence Dennis co-authored a massive account of the case, attacking the prosecution's case in excruciating detail. It was published in 1946. Despite being legally off the hook, however, Dennis's best days were already behind him. He never fully disavowed his views on fascism, though in the 1950s, he opposed the red-baiting of McCarthyism and the arms buildup of the Cold War on isolationist grounds. After the war, he published a new political newsletter that had some powerful subscribers in Washington. But his past associations with fascism made him politically untouchable to nearly all mainstream politicians. In 1964, he became vaguely involved in Barry Goldwater's ill-fated presidential campaign, but the connection went nowhere. He died in 1977, never publicly embracing his African-American heritage, and unable to overcome the perception that he was an unrepentant Nazi sympathizer. William Dudley Pelley, the colorful leader of the Silver Legion, had the most successful, and strange, post-war career of the accused seditionists. Despite the 1944 mistrial, the chief still had a substantial sentence to serve for his other convictions. He remained in prison until 1950, continuing to write and becoming a figure of sympathy for the far right. A Justice for Pelley committee argued that the chief was the victim of a communist conspiracy and called for his release. After finally getting out of prison, Pelley remained on parole until 1957 and resumed his career as a spiritualist. He again issued prophecies related to world events and published 24 books laying out a new spiritual system he called Soulcraft. This was essentially a revised version of his previous mystical teachings, with added complexity that made the overall philosophy almost incomprehensible to all but the most dedicated students. He also became interested in UFOs and alleged alien abductions. Toward the end of his life, Pelley claimed to have used his spiritualist techniques to contact the spirit of 16th century French prognosticator Michel Nostradamus during a séance. Nostradamus then supposedly put Pelley in touch with the souls of famous historical figures, including George Washington and Mark Twain. Accounts of these conversations were published in a new Soulcraft journal, and devotees were even offered the chance to buy audio tapes of the alleged discussions. It was a strange end to the even stranger career of a man who once saw himself as the American Hitler and convinced thousands of armed followers he was right. The chief died in 1965. Soulcraft survived his death, and Pelley's writings on extraterrestrials have been integrated into aspects of the ufology movement. His anti-Semitic writings are periodically cited on far-right websites to the present day. For his part, Gerald B. Winrod went back to Kansas to resume his career as a firebrand preacher. He quickly found, however, that practically all of Winrod's friends had forsaken him. As a sympathetic biographer put it, the sedition controversy left him with only a small but dedicated following. He now adopted a new and bizarre personal crusade. Winrod somehow became aware of Harry Hoxie, a former insurance salesman who claimed to have discovered an herbal cure for cancer. Hoxie had been marketing the Hoxie therapy for years and had naturally attracted the scrutiny and criticism of both the government and the mainstream medical profession. For reasons that remain opaque, Winrod now adopted alternative cancer treatments as his new cause and began touting a range of non-traditional remedies. To further the effort, he established a group called the Christian Medical Research League and began raising money to battle the mainstream medical establishment. The Food and Drug Administration was not amused, nor was the American Medical Association. The operation soon went bust. His biographer offers no explanation for the bizarre episode other than Winrod's deep-seated empathy for every underdog in the world and burning distrust of the government. By 1948, Winrod was physically ailing, but, in line with his personal views, refused to seek medical treatment. Instead, he relied on one of the alternative remedies he had been pushing to the public. It would be of little help. As it turned out, Winrod was suffering from multiple sclerosis. He concealed the illness from all but his closest friends and refused any semblance of medical care until the bitter end. He died in 1957. Remarkably, the organization he had founded decades before to battle the forces of modernism and the theory of evolution, Defenders of the Christian Faith, survives to the present day and has no association with the questionable views of its founder. Similarly, Father Charles E. Coughlin's reputation never recovered from his flirtation with Nazism. Silenced by his church superiors in 1942, he remained on the government's radar for years. In late 1941, the FBI received a tip that Coughlin was in communication with far-right groups seeking to overthrow the Mexican government with the help of Nazi agents. Naval intelligence and the FBI investigated the troubling claims. Agents were soon visiting the Shrine of the Little Flower and listening in on his sermons to find out whether he was making subversive statements. Meanwhile, Christian front groups continued to cause trouble across the country. Nothing concrete was ever found linking Coughlin to the Mexican plot or the remaining Christian front, but both journalists and government investigators kept digging into Coughlin's affairs for years, in the hope of finding a smoking gun linking him to money from the German embassy or other malfeasance. Even if there was no smoking gun to be found, the reality was that Coughlin had become rich through his rabble-rousing. In 1942, government investigators discovered a British bank account linked to Coughlin that contained a substantial $900,000, about $14 million today. After the war, Coughlin became involved in real estate speculation and bought homes in Arizona and Florida. He also purchased a house in Michigan near the home of Governor George Romney. As his obituary in the Detroit Free Press dryly noted, since he was not a member of a religious order, Father Coughlin was not bound by the vow of poverty. For all his wealth, however, Coughlin's political days were long behind him. He remained silent on the major issues of the day, building his personal fortune and ostensibly living the life of a parish priest. He was pushed into retirement by his church superiors in 1966 and began publishing tracts attacking the liberalizing reforms of the Second Ecumenical Council of the Vatican, Vatican II. Toward the end of his life, he told an interviewer that he stood by his writings in social justice, and still believed the United States should have stayed out of World War II. If we had stayed out of the war, we could have conquered the conqueror in Europe, he said. The war, he went on, was the greatest faux pas in the world history of civilization, from the days of Adam and Eve down to the present. Coughlin died in October 1979 at the age of 88. His obituary was carried on the front page of the Detroit Free Press, indicating his enduring local fame. The church he built, the Shrine of the Little Flower, stands to the present day in Royal Oak, Michigan. A writer in the 1970s found out the basement where his staff processed incoming donations had been converted into a nursery school. This imposing tower of the church, from which the priest made most of his broadcasts, had fallen into disarray, and his former office was covered with pigeon droppings and feathers. It was a physical metaphor for his career. The edifice Coughlin built through his demagoguery still stood, but its interior was rotten. Gerald L. K. Smith was more vocal than Winrod or Coughlin in his continuing devotion to the extremist cause. During the sedition trial, he raised money to support the defendants. His biographer has suggested this was part of a ploy to attract their followers for himself in the post-war world. After the war, Smith became a Holocaust denier and claimed Hitler's memory was being defamed by the Jewish press. He continued to rabble-rouse across the country, opposing the United Nations and maintaining his economic populism. The FBI kept close tabs on him throughout. Unsurprisingly, he became a supporter of Senator Joseph McCarthy's red-baiting in the 1950s and supported segregation in the South, even attempting to run for president on the breakaway Dixiecrat ticket in 1948. Senator Strom Thurmond torpedoed his chances with the Dixiecrats by securing the nomination himself. Smith subsequently ran as the Christian Nationalist Party's nominee, but the campaign was a miserable failure. Smith ended up as an embittered and reluctant supporter of President Richard Nixon, despite the fact that Nixon had denounced Smith and his band of supporters as extremists in the past. He died in 1976, a prejudiced relic of an earlier time. Despite his undeniable oratorical gifts and the political skills he had honed with Huey Long, Smith's career ultimately came to nothing. He was consumed by hatred and racism. After the war, he was little more than a throwback to an earlier time, who maintained a following by appealing to the darkest instincts and traditions in American society. In the end, a biographer has written, his true legacy is bigotry. Hitler's most important agent in the United States, George Sylvester Viereck, was similarly ruined. During the post-war Nuremberg trials, the U.S. government gained huge amounts of information about the extent of his operations. He was eventually released from prison in 1947, following the final collapse of the sedition trial, and attempted to revive his career as a novelist and poet. Nothing landed well in the market until he published his memoirs, entitled Men into Beasts, in 1952. The book became notorious for its portrayal of male rape Viereck had witnessed in prison, and eventually sold about 500,000 copies. Viereck died in 1962, never able to escape his reputation as a dangerous Nazi sympathizer. Viereck's main ally at the German embassy had been First Secretary Heribert von Strempel. In December 1941, Strempel accompanied German charge d'affaires Hans Thompson to personally deliver the Third Reich's declaration of war to Franklin Roosevelt. Strempel's work as a diplomat was temporarily finished with the declaration of war, and he sat in Washington until arrangements could be made to return him in a formal diplomatic exchange. From there, he returned to the Lisbon branch of the Foreign Ministry Press Department. After the war, he was quickly declared denazified and took a job with the newspaper Die Zeit. This would have been the end of Strempel's story, except for the existence of recently declassified CIA files. As it turns out, the agency recruited Strempel in November 1947 to act as a spy against the Soviets. Strempel, whose CIA code name was Hiawatha, was recruited as part of an operation called Alcatraz that was designed to obtain economic and political data about organizations in the Soviet sector. Strempel was chosen because subject is strongly inclined toward the Anglo-Saxon powers and has innumerable good friends in the U.S. He still has considerable property, which, although blocked now, he hopes to see again someday. Strempel's job as a journalist also meant that he required no cover or backstory. However, it appears that while Strempel was successfully recruited, he was never actually used as an agent, and was quietly dismissed in 1948 when his handler returned to America. The exact reason is unclear, although his agent record states he was too marginal a case, never used. It appears he was in touch with the CIA again in 1966, but the available files are again unclear why. Whether the release of further information in the future will shed further light on Strempel's post-war career remains to be seen. No trace of him can be found in American newspapers after a few mentions in 1947. He appears to have died in West Germany in 1981. Virek and Strempel's connections in Congress were completely destroyed by a combination of the franking scandal and their outspoken isolationist views. Senator Ernest Lundeen was, of course, long dead, but his collaborators were still in office for the time being. In 1942, journalists Michael Sayers and Albert E. Kahn published a sensationalist expose entitled Sabotage, The Secret War Against America. As with Undercover, Walter Winchell praised the book, and it sold more than 150,000 copies in just 3 days. Among other startling revelations, it demonstrated the extent of Virek's Capitol Hill machinations and named 20 politicians who had their franks used in the scheme. These members of Congress were the political heroes of the America First Committee. The book devastatingly concluded, America First had now been directly linked to the work of a Nazi agent. The key player in the Virek-Fish scheme, Congressman Hamilton Fish III, was narrowly re-elected in 1942. But the damage only got worse from there. In 1944, direct mail advertising expert Henry Hoke penned a pamphlet entitled Black Mail that focused on Fish's involvement with Virek. Images showing Fish speeches being directly quoted in Nazi propaganda newspapers added insult to injury. The political opportunity was now too great to pass up. Fish's opponent in the 1944 election flooded the district with thousands of copies of publications highlighting the Virek affair. Fish was duly defeated, ending his 25-year tenure in Congress. As the official history of British security coordination noted, he blamed Reds and Communists for the defeat, but might, with more accuracy, have blamed BSC for uncovering and revealing the Virek plot. Fish never ran for public office again and died at the age of 102 in 1991. He defended his isolationist views to the end, telling an audience at the age of 101, I have always opposed war, and sometimes it has made trouble for me. I often feel I am a voice in the wilderness, but what can one man do? A similar fate befell isolationist Republican Senator Gerald P. Nye, following extensive criticism of his foreign policy views and his vocal defense of Charles Lindbergh. Nye lost his seat in 1944. His political career was over, and he died in 1971. The same was true of Senator Burton K. Wheeler. Outraged by his defiance of Roosevelt, links to Virek, and the devastating portrayal of him as a pro-Nazi appeaser in Undercover, the Montana Democratic Party ousted him in the 1946 primaries. The Republicans then picked up his seat handily in November. Wheeler was convinced that Jews and communists were responsible for the defeat. Every day that goes by proves to me more conclusively than ever that communists are using a lot of these Jewish people as pawns to stir up racial intolerance in this country, he told newspaper columnist and radio broadcaster George Sikolsky in 1944. The amazing thing to me is that they would not have sense enough to realize that they were being used. You have to give the communists credit. They know what they want and where they are going. Wheeler's reputation never recovered, and he died in 1975. Both he and Nye were remembered in their obituaries as leaders of the isolationist movement. I think I was right then, and I still do, Wheeler told a reporter 2 years before his death. I said that if we got into war, we'll make the world safe for the communists, and that's what we're doing. Hitler's friends in the business community would soon be looking for ways to escape the consequences of their own involvement with the Reich. The key player was, once again, O. John Roga, the prosecutor in the unsuccessful sedition trial. As Roga was preparing for a potential revival of the case in 1946, he suddenly received word from a U.S. Army captain that there was dramatic evidence being uncovered in Germany about the network of Nazi sympathizers in North America. Realizing the possible implications, Roga traveled to Germany with a small staff and started investigating. What he uncovered was shocking. Obtaining interviews with the most prominent Nazis still alive, including Hermann Göring, Roga was able to put direct questions to the people who had personally plotted to undermine U.S. politics. Poring over captured files from various government ministries, he determined that the Nazis had a far-reaching network of sympathizers, spies, and supporters in the United States, who were far more dangerous than the defendants he was currently prosecuting. The most insidious threat, he claimed, came from the German and American industrialists, who had conspired to undermine the country. William Rhodes Davis was on the list, but it had many other names as well. Roga produced an extensive report outlining these findings and citing huge amounts of evidence for submission to his boss, Attorney General Tom Clark. The nation's chief law enforcement officer was shocked, but not for the reasons Roga had hoped. Rather than insist on a far-reaching investigation, Clark was appalled that his friend Burton K. Wheeler was mentioned specifically in the draft document. Clark decreed that the report would remain secret, but Roga convinced him that it should at least be completed. When it was done, Clark asked Roga to redact the names of the prominent Americans included in its pages. Roga refused, and an awkward standoff between the men resulted. The time-honored Washington tradition of leaking to the press now came into play. Within days of the report's completion, excerpts were mysteriously passed to political columnist Drew Pearson and published in his nationally syndicated column, Washington Merry-Go-Round. Roga publicly confirmed the veracity of the text, but denied leaking it to Pearson. Within days, however, he began speaking out in public and revealed some of the report's further findings, mentioning Wheeler and others by name. Shortly after, he was approached by an FBI agent in an airport and handed an envelope. Inside was a letter from Clark firing him immediately. As it turned out, Wheeler was longtime friends with another former senator who had recently found a new employment, President Harry Truman. Appalled by the appearance of Wheeler's name in the press, the president summoned Clark to the White House and ordered him to fire Roga. The excuse given was that Roga had quoted publicly from his own report, which was officially considered secret. Roga would not be silenced so easily, however. To Clark's dismay, Roga kept traveling the country and began writing articles to discuss his findings. He alleged publicly that the report was being withheld because it names Americans who collaborated with the Nazis. The former assistant attorney general also explosively charged that the army had shut down the FBI's investigations into the Nazi espionage network, leading to the possibility that it might survive in the United States and fall into the wrong hands. FBI agents closely monitored his public statements and investigated whether Roga might have become a Soviet agent. Nothing conclusive was ever found, though agents claimed to have found evidence of Roga praising communist leaders. Regardless, Roga went on to become a private practice attorney and wrote a book criticizing the FBI for violating the civil liberties of investigation targets. He later became involved in the ACLU and took on a range of First Amendment cases. After much lobbying, Roga was finally allowed in 1961 to publish his report on Nazi infiltration of the United States, long after many of the key players named in it were either dead or out of office. It was the first time the American public had heard anything close to the full story of what he had discovered about Hitler's American friends. Where in the U.S. there was a Fritz Kuhn, there is now a George Lincoln Rockwell, the head of the American Nazi Party, a Philadelphia Inquirer reviewer reflected after reading Roge's book. And unfortunately, the merchants of hate always seemed to have someone to listen to them. Roge kept up the fight against political extremism until the end of his life. He died in 1981 and was remembered as the man who had helped bring down both Huey Long's political machine and Hitler's American friends. Despite Roge's investigative activities, America's corporate leaders continued to reap the rewards of their German investments throughout the war and after. Coca-Cola's German division continued producing Fanta and amassing profits, even as its trademark beverage became unavailable due to the British embargo. Coca-Cola's American wing cleverly positioned itself with the advancing U.S. Army, providing a taste of home to weary soldiers. As the Reich began to collapse, the Nazi state targeted Coca-Cola GmbH as a subversive company that was harming morale by reminding war-weary Germans of happier times. Its chief, Max Keitt, courageously refused to change the company name, despite the threat of being sent to a concentration camp. At the end of the war, Keitt wired corporate American headquarters to announce the company's survival. For his efforts, Keitt was initially hailed as a hero by Coca-Cola, but was soon sidelined as American managers took over his operation. He eventually managed to locate a large stock of Coke concentrate and reestablish his position in the company. Coca-Cola had successfully weathered the storm to remain the world's favorite soft drink. In the process, it had also invented a new soda, Fanta, that remains popular to the present day. Ford and General Motors also paid little price for their liaison with the Nazis. The Ford Werke plant in Cologne continued operations and received its first batch of French prisoner of war laborers in 1940. From there, the situation only got worse. In 1942, Ford produced 120,000 trucks for the German army, in comparison to Opel GM's 50,000. In October 1944, the U.S. Air Force attempted to bomb the Ford factory, but hit the laborers' barracks instead. By then, the Allies were closing in on Cologne, and a general evacuation was soon ordered. The factory itself would not be occupied until March 1945. Liberating American soldiers would find freezing slave laborers from the Soviet Union and elsewhere confined by barbed wire to the facility. The U.S. government predictably began exploring the connections between the Ford family and their corporate interests in both Germany and occupied countries in Europe. In 1943, an investigation concluded that Ford's operations in France were being used for the benefit of Germany, and that this had been approved by Henry Ford himself. Despite the damning verdict, no action was taken by the U.S. government. One reason was undoubtedly that Ford's leadership in the United States was undergoing abrupt transition. Edsel Ford, Henry Ford's son and heir apparent, died gruesomely of gastric cancer in May 1943, at the age of just 49. Edsel's son Benson blamed his father's early death on the immense pressure placed on him by the family patriarch, reportedly proclaiming, "Grandfather is responsible for father's sickness." Henry Ford's wife, Clara, seems to have agreed and distanced herself from her husband for 2 months after Edsel's funeral. The death created the potential for a dangerous power vacuum at the top of one of America's most powerful corporations. 2 years after Edsel's death, the aged Henry Ford recommended his grandson, Henry Ford II, be given the role of company president at the age of 28. The younger Ford quickly denounced the anti-Semitism of his grandfather and reached out to the Jewish community to begin repairing the damage incurred in the 1930s. Henry Ford himself died in 1947 at the age of 83, his name irrevocably sullied by his association with anti-Semitism and Hitler. Neither he nor his son would face the consequences of their flirtation with the Nazis and the material support they had provided the German war effort. In 1956, Henry Ford II took the extraordinary step of offering Ford stock in an initial public offering, IPO. This was a move his grandfather had always rejected because he feared that Jew speculators would get a hold of the company's shares. The Ford IPO was the largest issuance of stock in American history, and thousands of people stood in line for hours to buy shares. The biggest beneficiary was the charitable Ford Foundation,